You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
So there we are, solving the stability and creativity conundrum. There's a challenge for our first panel. It's entitled Solving the Employment Puzzle. It's going to be chaired by Sarah O'Connor, who we're very pleased to have here today, who's employment correspondent for Financial Times. Sarah, over to you.
Very much. Well, I spend a lot of my time looking at charts and graphs and digging through data, and one of the most extraordinary ones is the rise in self-employment. And as you've alluded to, this isn't something that just happened when the recession hit. It was happening before. But when you look at that chart, it's as if the recession never happened at all. The numbers just go up and up and up in a kind of continuous rise. And obviously, this is part of the reason that our labour market has managed to kind of get through the recession with a lot less unemployment than we saw in lots of other countries. So it's a fascinating topic for economists and also obviously for policymakers, as you've alluded to. And the big question that I think we're going to all try and grapple with is this one of why. You know, is this sort of disguised underemployment or unemployment? Is this the budding new creative class that you allude to? Or is it also the fact that some sectors seem to be using self-employment contracts now as a way of kind of abrogating traditional employer responsibilities? So I think we saw that very clearly with CityLink's demise, where we learned that actually a lot of those workers were technically self-employed, but they had to buy their own CityLink uniforms. They couldn't work for any other company. They had to buy kind of branded liveried vans, and they had to turn up for work every morning the same as everyone else. So I think there are lots of kind of critical questions we can ask about what's going on with self-employment and how much of it is the stuff that we should welcome and how much of it is the stuff that we should worry about. We've got a great, over here on my far left, we have Stephen Toft, who you probably know as Flipchart Rick. He writes a very well-read blog. Here we have Patricia van den Acker. She is the director of the Design Trust, an online business school. To my right, we have Tom Hodgkinson, editor of The Idler, a literary and philosophical magazine. And on my far right, we have Emma Jones, a small business expert and the author and founder of Enterprise Nation. And I know for a fact that they have very interesting and not necessarily the same opinions as each other. Okay, so let's start with Stephen.
Okay.
Thanks, Stephen.
My name's Stephen Toft. About coming up for 12 years ago now, I walked away from a perfectly good job with a big corporation to set up a consultancy firm with some friends. Since then, it's been great fun. We've done all sorts of things. In 2007, I decided to start writing a blog, which was going to be something poking fun at things that happen in the world of work, which is why it's got a silly name called Flipchart Fairy Tales. Somewhere along the line, around the financial crisis, it got a bit serious, and I started writing serious things, and people started reading them, which is what I'm doing here today. I used to think I was self-employed, but according to the HMRC, I'm actually not, because there are various different definitions of self-employment. The HMRC's got one, different ones in the Labour Force Survey, different ones in the BIS statistics. The one thing they all do have in common, though, is you can get hung up about definitions, but the lines on the graph all go in the same way. The number of people goes up and the amount of money goes down. So we have 600,000 more people self-employed in 2013 than, according to HMRC, than we did in 2008. Between them, they managed to earn £8 billion less. That's in cash terms. If you look at the BIS statistics that came out recently, New Policy Institute did a paper on it a couple of weeks ago. In terms of turnover per person for the businesses without employees has been in steady decline since 2003. It was actually less before the recession than it was in 2003, and then since the recession it's fallen quite considerably. So if you look at employment share, it's gone up. If you look at turnover share, it's gone down. And in terms of turnover, businesses with more than 500 employees have a bigger share of turnover now than they did in 2003. So, as I say, while the numbers are going up, the money is going down. It reminds me of one of those David Attenborough films where you've got a drought and more animals come to drink from an ever-shrinking oasis. It's a bit like that. So, yes, there is something going on in the economy. There are more self-employed people. But in terms of money, the sector has actually shrunk. I'll stop there and leave that with you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. A gloomy start.
I will try and cheer us up, shall I? Hello, my name is Patricia van den Ecker and I'm the director of the Design Trust. It always sounds very nice, but indeed I'm self-employed. I'm the director, the finance manager, the marketing manager, the tea lady and everything in between. I actually work with three regular freelancers and indeed I'm very proud that my communications manager is based in Bologna and I only indeed communicate via Skype and email with her. The Design Trust itself is quite an interesting example. It was set up 20 years ago as a charity and very much kind of government funded at that time. It was then taken over by London Met University at the beginning of the century, and 3 years ago I took it over. And I've been really turning it into what I would call a lean but very successful social enterprise. The Design Trust website gets now around 50,000 visitors per month. I work mostly with creative freelancers, designers and makers, from the cool kids in East London designing apps to technophobes in traditional crafts in the middle of nowhere. Even in this creative subgroup of highly motivated sole traders, I can see very clear smaller subgroups, each with their own motivations and business needs. I work, for example, with recent graduates in design and crafts who need basic business skills, marketing and presentation skills, because the art colleges mostly don't provide it to them. I work with so-called mompreneurs, a term I absolutely hate, by the way, but who are mostly women in their 40s with a great career, very often in finance, marketing or legal, and they've actually either been made redundant or they're being fed up with the system. Often they work in partnership and very often indeed married to a rich husband, which is very useful. Then we've got the established makers who've been going for over 20 years, but now have seen a massive decrease in their gallery sales and need to catch up with online selling and social media. And I also indeed work with a couple of highly successful sellers, people who are making more than £100,000 a year, mostly selling online through Not on the High Street. So what are those long-term trends? And being a creative business advisor, I kind of had to get back to the old model of PASL, political, economic, social, technology, legal and environmental, to work this out for myself. In political trends, I see it's extremely easy to set up a business in the UK. If I compare it, I come from Holland originally, let me tell you, the UK is extremely simple to set up your own business. Maybe a little bit too simple sometimes. It's very limited requirements on knowledge and experience levels. For example, when I studied graphic design in Belgium, I had marketing and bookkeeping 4 hours a week. There is a very high VAT threshold here in the UK, which means a lot less paperwork than a lot of other European countries, and a lot less likely that you actually need to work with an accountant in this country. There's a very high level of creative students in the UK. There are more UK graduates in crafts and design than the rest of Europe together. For example, indeed, the comparison with the Netherlands. My sister runs her own business very successfully in Holland, so we compare notes on a regular basis. It's far harder, for example, to be a part-time sole trader in Holland. For example, she works part-time. She's got a disabled child, and she can actually not deduct all her costs because she's working part-time. You also need to have a minimum amount of 3 clients. You need somebody I recently spoke to, they only had 3 clients, and they said that's not enough. So you need to have at least a minimum of 6 or 7 clients. And the VAT threshold is far lower. There's economical trends, of course, like redundancies in the city and the public sector have definitely caused an influx in the creative sector. People looking for more meaning, overstretched mums, parents, in particular looking for a new challenge. Let's be honest, I've got two young kids myself. It's very hard to do a 9-to-5 job as a parent in the UK. There's a very limited flexible childcare. It's very hard to find and very expensive. The importance of getting meaning from work, I think, has really grown. I grew up in the 1970s with two workaholic parents. I didn't want that, thank you very much. I don't think I can have it all anymore, and I don't want to. In remote areas, it's hard to get a job. I work a lot with people, indeed, in Scotland, in the Highlands, in the Islands. I'm working in a moment with a fourth-generation knife maker. Let me tell you, they've got great stories to tell. And online selling is absolutely amazing. The more part-timers, older, and parents becoming sole traders. And let's be honest, I do think there is some cause there with job centres and benefit sanctions and things like that. Many sole traders might earn very little, but as there are very few alternatives, this is a crucial income for the family. There's a lot of people making maybe £4,000 or £5,000, don't even pay tax. But I was quite involved with the FATMOS impact at the end of last year, and I really saw the impact of that regulation on a lot of the very, very small companies who are providing digital information, for example, through e-books and online trainings. Also, there's a couple of things like around social trends. I think English is a leading trade language. It's far easier here to set up. If I would be running a block in Dutch, I would have about 5,000 people joining me. There's clusters of creativity, and I think especially the LDA, when we had Creative London, was very much stimulating those creative clusters, especially in cities like London. One of the things, indeed, from the report, what I thought was really interesting, entrepreneurship is contagious. If you see other people doing it, you go on the bandwagon too. And it's a lot more accepted with a lot less full-time PRAE jobs. Technology trends, social media use is very high in the UK. Buying online is a lot more expected here in the UK than in any other European countries. And there are loads of fantastic selling opportunities, especially Etsy. And not on the high street. And okay, we might not agree, but relatively to a lot of other European countries, there is relatively fastish broadband. I went recently to Berlin. I can tell you it's better here. So I think it's a combination of so many different factors. I think there's a lot more research needs to be done and taken into account by policymakers, especially as we've seen with the recent FATMOS debacle, where many very small sole traders were caught up in strategic decisions by the EU. More info about the numbers need to be involved and their business needs and impact. There's many small ones, but together they make up a large part of the economy and our society.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Okay, Tom?
My name's Tom Hodgkinson. I'm an author and a journalist. And about 21 years ago, or actually 23 years ago, I had the idea to start a magazine called The Idler. And this had a very negative motivation. It was motivated purely and simply by me really, really hating my job and feeling stuck in a 9-to-5, which I despised. And I looked forward, and I'd just left university, perhaps 2 or 3 years out of university. And at college, you know, I'd had a great time, a lot of autonomy and a lot of the kind of creativity that Adam was talking about in his great opening address there. You know, one was in control of one's own time. We played in bands, we started our own magazines, me and my friends. We also worked and, you know, enjoyed the academic work as well. You were master of your own day, week, term. You could even sort of take part-time jobs at the same time. So you had this kind of blank canvas. But going from that into the world of work was a completely different thing. I had 1 year, actually, quite a fun job working in a skateboarding and record shop called Rough Trade. And then I thought, well, I better get on with my, you know, my career, and ended up working 3 or 4 days a week on a tabloid magazine, the Sunday Mirror magazine, as a journalist. But felt, you know, sort of trapped and humiliated and underpaid and all those things that the journalist field. But also, which actually are a natural concomitant for most people, of a full-time job. And so around this time, I started reading the essays of Dr. Johnson, who, as you know, wrote a dictionary in the 18th century. And What surprised me to find out was that he was also incredibly lazy, but very productive. And he wrote a series of essays called The Idler, just around the corner from here, 1758, 1759. And while he was ambivalent about his own constitutional indolence, he partly celebrated it. And he said, you know, I work very, very quickly. He used to lie in bed all morning and get up about 12 or 1. Every Christmas and every New Year and on his birthday, he would resolve to get up earlier the following year. because I get up at 10, I'm going to resolve to get up at 8, and I might get up at 9. That's earlier than I currently do rise. He continued these resolutions until he was 60 or 70. In other words, he never achieved it. But he was enormously productive. When did he get the work done? He got it done very, very quickly. And he talked about the principle of momentum. There was a huge build-up when he was apparently doing nothing, lying in bed, staring out of the window, but actually was deeply involved in his work because he was thinking. And he said the longer he did that, the quicker he could get the work done on the deadline. So the printer's boy would be at the door, taking each sheet of manuscript as it came from under his pen or quill, run to the printer's office and run back, and he never even read over it. And then, exhausted by this kind of hour of labour, he'd then go out to the pub with Boswell or whatever. So I thought, that sounds like a nice way to run things. We put Dr. Johnson on the first... He was our first cover star on The Idler magazine. So what I want to do is to kind of unite the, what you might also call a punk sensibility, because I love the punk movement, and most of the punk bands had actually revolted against the idea of what has been called, since the middle of the 19th century by anarchist writers, wage slavery, a job. Mm-hmm. So you go into work, the punk band said, you know, you spend money that you haven't yet earned on the credit card, and then you have to go in and work to pay off that debt. And that's still the case now. So can we escape from that? Do I have to open a letter bomb for you, the Clash song, in career opportunities? You know, the specials talked about rat race, working for the rat race. So all these ideas were in my head. And could I combine that with an 18th century sensibility? Well, that all sounds rather indulgent and bohemian. And in fact, that's the theme I want to talk about in the next 2 or 3 minutes. But I also realised that you had to some extent, get your head around business concepts. And so having quit my job, or actually I was sacked, luckily.
Because you weren't getting out of bed till
12. I wasn't getting out of bed in the morning. Somehow this attitude, they detected this bad attitude. I went home and I signed on and went on the Dole. And actually ended up on a kind of Dolly's business course. I want to start my own business. So a group of us went on this course, and it was actually quite useful. They talked about things like fixed costs. This is in 1992, I think, 93. And got some business ideas through, because, you know, if you are to be self-employed, you have to be sensible about things like money. So that was the kind of beginning of my journey into self-employment. I now haven't had a job since 1997, I think. But the strange thing about starting a magazine which rejected conventional employment is that I was offered a job on the back of it. The Guardian newspaper, the marketing department, became fans of The Idler, and they employed my partner then, Gavin Preter-Pinney, and me to work on special projects at The Guardian. So we had our own department. We were employed for 2 or 3 years, running a team of 10 or 15 people, working on what they call product development. So we would have a meeting with the editor and introduce ideas to energise existing sections or come up with ideas for new sections. One of them was called Jobs and Money, which doesn't sound very idlerish, but there we have it. This is a wonderful job, but even having such a great job, I found the corporate life constraining. The first year was wonderful. The second year at The Guardian, Gavin and me both felt that we weren't really doing that much work. We were expected to get ourselves involved in office politics. And you started to take on jobs you didn't really want to do so as not to rock the boat. And it was difficult to sort of really get anything done. I also had an enormous amount of time, I remember. It's a very inefficient way of working, being self-employed. And I was on the phone all afternoon to my girlfriend, Victoria, who's here, in the audience, who remembers this. Gavin and I then quit and started our own consultancy. And we suddenly found, my girlfriend Victoria found that these calls stopped because we were working for ourselves, and we were working very, very hard, actually. We did fairly well for 2 or 3 years. We had advertising clients, and we also ran the Idler ourselves. And then again, I got fed up with that, and unable to stick at anything, quit this quite successful consultancy job, or business that we'd started. There were three of us then, to write books. And then Victoria and I retired to the countryside about 12 or 13 years ago, and I wrote 4 or 5 books while in renting a farmhouse in North Devon. And this was quite a nice period. We had small children. The first of these books was called How to Be Idle. The second was called How to Be Free. Most of them are still in print. They've sold all over the world, so that's been that was good. 3 or 4 years ago, Victoria and I started setting up events at festivals under the banner of the Idler Academy, the Idler Academy of Philosophy, Husbandry and Merriment. So we want to teach forgotten subjects, teach Socrates and Plato, teach things like ukulele, teach people how to sew a button onto a jacket properly. So the first talk we ever had was with a Savile Row tailor in a tent at the Port Elliot Festival. And this was really successful. We also taught grammar in the old-fashioned way, and even Latin, zoology, astronomy, anything we felt like, really, including business. And people enjoyed this. And rather foolishly, Victoria and I, having run this event for 3 days, decided that we could do this every day of the year, and remortgaged our house and took out the lease on a shop in an obscure corner of Notting Hill, opposite the Cow pub and the Westbourne pub, and opened our doors. Emma remembers coming in the first few weeks, and threw ourselves into really proper business, and it's been absolute hell. It's been extraordinarily good fun, and the freedom that Adam talked about has been wonderful. Yeah. But the pressure on two people who didn't really know what they were doing to pay staff, to manage staff, to pay HMRC, to pay VAT, to pay rates, rent on a property, to keep the property in good order, to do all the marketing and everything on our own, has been very, very extremely hard work. So overnight, I turned from this kind of hippie layabout guru into some horrific cross between David Brent from The Office and Basil Fawlty. And remained in a kind of state of heightened panic for sort of 2 or 3 years. We're now coming to the end of the fourth year, and I'm glad to report that, without wanting this to be a kind of annual report to shareholders, that the fourth quarter sales were about 50% year-on-year up on like-for-like sales on Q4 of 2013. And it looks like we've sort of turned the corner. We set up a course, actually, for people like us, called Business for Bohemians. I really want to encourage people to do this, to go into business, to quit work, to quit the wage slavery, to get out of their boring job and do something they really want to do. But also you have to acknowledge how difficult this can be. People study business as a thing on its own. You go to Harvard Business School for years and years. And so it's a little glib and a little too easy, I think, to tell people, turn your passion into your project. You're knitting baby booties at home, open a shop on Etsy, and tomorrow you'll be making 100 grand a year. It's not that easy. There are a lot of different concepts to take on board. But it is possible. It is enormously good fun. And it can lead to the creativity and autonomy that we're all looking for.
Absolutely. Emma Jones from Enterprise Nation. I would just like to start with my memory from the Idler Academy, which is, it was quite ironic that the course that I had gone to teach at the Idler Academy is, I run something still actually every month called Startup Saturday. So Tom had said to me, right, can you come and do a startup course here at the Idler Academy? And it is a beautiful shop. I would encourage you all to visit and browse and buy the books. But I was sitting at the back of the shop with a table of people who'd come in all incredibly excited about taking their baby booties from the kitchen table to starting a business. And so sure enough, we were going through, right, how do you write a business plan, make sure you're getting your sales right, create a home on the web. And Tom was literally running around us on this table, kind of saying to everyone, don't do it, don't do it. So I love the fact that we kind of caught you in those heady days of this is a terrible decision. So back to the introduction. Adam mentioned there are people who are very rosy about startups and self-employment, and I have to confess I am one of those people. So I run Enterprise Nation. We help people take their idea and start and grow a business, which I'm going to mention in a minute more about growth. But I was also the founder of a three-year campaign called Startup Britain, which launched in 2011 by politicians, actually, who were very active to get behind the whole startup boom. It ran till 2014, and lots of other things have come into the landscape. The government have introduced startup loans, the startup boot camps. I've just come from a breakfast in Tech City, where it's all startup town over there. And I have to say, I think this is a brilliant thing for the UK. And I know the title of this panel is Self-Employment, the Puzzle, which made me smile because I just thought, why are we questioning whether it's right or wrong? And it's very good we're questioning whether it's right or wrong. But to me, if we were in America, they wouldn't call it self-employment the puzzle. They would call it self-employment let's celebrate. This is something to be celebrated, that so many people are taking an idea and cautiously turning that into a business. So the stats haven't necessarily been mentioned, but 2013, 524,000 people took the decision to start a business. Last year, it was over 560,000. I think that will level out this year because I do think we've kind of come to a peak. But what we're seeing in the UK is an entrepreneurial culture. Patricia mentioned that entrepreneurship is contagious, and this is what you see particularly in London, but more so now in other cities, is you will sit in a coffee shop and somebody will be writing a business plan or talking to their friend to say, how do I go and pitch this to John Lewis? How do I go and look for a co-founder? So the more people do it, absolutely, the more other people get confidence to do it too. So I think it's a great thing. To this point about turnover, which drives me mad, is all the people that we see who are self-employed, and it could be said later on that maybe I only see the people who are very happy about starting a business, but they are happier, healthier and wealthier. And the reason being is lots of the Enterprise Nation membership run their businesses from home. Why are they happier and healthier? Because they've lost that horrible commute every morning, so they're saving up extra hours every week, which they could spend time with the family, spend time walking in the park, spend time learning languages, spend time in their local community. Speaking of which, they are spending an extra $40 billion in their local communities. So we did a home business survey in October of last year, questioned 1,500 home-based businesses. $40 billion extra is going into their local economy because they're running the business from home. They're self-policing daytime neighbourhoods. Mums and dads are running businesses from home, so they're educating the next generation of entrepreneurs, which I love. Kids are growing up thinking business is the most natural thing in the world, which will help the UK in the future because we'll have more entrepreneurs. And this point about turnover is what nobody ever measures, and we did measure this in the Home Business Report, is everyone does a direct correlation. So say you're an employee and you're earning £40,000. You then start a business and that business only earns, say, £32,000, £25,000 less. What you don't count is the less travel costs of going into a job, the expensive boxed office lunches that you buy when you go into a job, even, dare I say, and this sounds like a trite point, clothes. That when you go into a job in an office and play office politics, you have to look the part, so you have to buy extra fashion. When you're running a business from home, yes, you have to look professional, but all of those costs come down. And we did, in the Home Business Survey, we did a direct calculation to say employee, home-based, self-employed entrepreneur actually earning about the same amounts. And just the other thing I'd question about the Biz turnover statistics, and I don't know if there's anyone here from Biz Today, but I see John is here from Google, is we're talking to the Office for National Statistics because they have accepted that there's a lot of turnover on sites like Etsy, Not on the High Street, Elance.com, iStockPhoto.com, eBay, that is not being counted in turnover levels. So there's possibly a lot of turnover that's just simply not being accounted in the official figures. So I would say that I think self-employment on the rise is a brilliant thing for Britain. I think we can never have too many entrepreneurs. But what I would also say is I think the self-employed need three things to make sure that they kind of continue to grow and make the most of it. And one is advice about how to grow. So with over 500,000 new businesses being formed in the UK, what they do need, and everything that Tom's just said, if Tom could have gone to somebody, you know, 1 year into the Idler Academy and said, right, what do I do about increasing sales? Can I do more online? He probably did this. But every small business owner will say when they start the business on their own, it's a very lonely journey. What they need to find is professional advisors, experts, mentors, peers from whom they can get advice. And just a very practical point on that, We've been involved with a government programme called Growth Vouchers, which was launched in January of last year. It's given small businesses money to get access to advice. Sadly, that programme's coming to an end at the end of March. So we are pitching and lobbying hard to say, can we secure funds from a private source to keep that programme going? Because what we're seeing is people are starting to take on the behaviour that you start a business and you need advice on how to grow it. So I do think all these record startups need advice. I also do think, and this has been mentioned, and it's great to hear the RSA say this, equalisation of benefits. So when it does come to pension provision, maternity pay, health insurance, someone came up to me the other day and said, I'm self-employed, what happens if I get sick? I was like, just don't get sick. So even things like that, and actually in the US, they are ahead of us. There's a brilliant organisation called the Freelancers Union. And what the Freelancers Union does is it accepts there's 56 million freelancers in the US and it curates benefits for those freelancers. And of course, the big benefit in the US that you don't have is medical cover. If you're not an employee, we don't have that issue here in the UK. But I do think, and politicians of all colours actually have come out and said they want to start looking now at equalisation of benefits for the self-employed. Which leads me on to the final and third thing that I think the self-employed need, which is a stronger voice in government. And the incredible thing about the self-employed, there are 4.9 million of them, and yet, and we know this at close hand, you do still have the bigger businesses get a bigger voice at the central table in government. And so what I think small businesses need, and it's great, I can see Dawn here from the National Enterprise Network, the FSB, Enterprise Nation plays its part, is all these organisations to put that collective voice of small business to government. Which just on the final point of that, and Adam said, you know, we should be here today doing the thinking of politicians, is I love the fact that small business has become quite a playball with the politicians, because the only people who will benefit from this is small businesses. So we're hosting the small business debate on the 2nd of March, where Vince Cable, Matt Hancock, UKIP, all five leaders, Natalie Bennett herself is coming from the Green Party, all five members of those parties are going to come and debate their particular stand when it comes to small business. The audience will be small business owners saying, right, we would like you to do this, we would like you to do that. And as I say, if the politicians feel the pressure, 5 million votes and counting, then hopefully the improvement in conditions for small businesses will come through. So as I say, conclusion from here is I think self-employment on the rise is a great thing. Yes, we need to look at 0 hours contracts, but what we should not overlook or ignore in the process of doing that is the millions of people who have found the freedom, the flexibility, the power to create and are loving the life of being self-employed.
Thank you very much. That was a really fascinating discussion. I've learnt lots already. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions myself. I'm going to use my privilege as the chair, and then I'll open it up to you guys. You mentioned, Emma, that you think that the growth is going to tail off now, and in the statistics we can see that after a long period of very rapid self-employment growth, for the last sort of 2, 3, 4 months, the self-employed numbers have been falling off. Does anyone have any thoughts about why that is? I mean, if we think that this is a boom that is driven by a desire for independence and the fact that there are all these new technologies like Etsy that make it easier, why would it be tailing off?
So I think 500,000 people is just about right in terms of the economy kind of meeting that demand. And I don't know whether it was Adam who said earlier, will markets just disappear for the self-employed? So are there only... And if Etsy are here, I was just going to say, are there only so many Etsy makers that the UK can carry? Which I don't believe. I think the more Etsy makers, the better. And to that point, what we are seeing the self-employed do, which then may lead to another spurt again, is they are looking beyond the UK markets. So businesses powered by the likes of Etsy, by Google, by Not on the High Street, are going global very quickly. But I think with the way that we have had 3 years of record growth in startups, I just feel that we will kind of get to the stage now where it levels off, but still, 500,000 startups every year is still a fine thing. And just interestingly to finish off on that, I suppose, and I alluded to this when home-based business owners bringing up the next generation of entrepreneurs, every time we do surveys of young people, every single time we do it, and we did the last one in September, round about 65% of young people always respond when we say, would you like to start a business? Around 65% always say at some point in their career they would like to become their own boss. So it's not as if we're kind of saying, right, we've hit 500,000 for 3 years, it will stop now and it will never increase, because if you look to the future generations, what they do want is, again, the liberty, the freedom that comes with starting a business.
Stephen, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. I think if you look at the self-employment statistics since the recession, a lot of it is because fewer people are leaving self-employment. So it's the rise is because a lot of people who would normally have left self-employment are sticking around in it. We don't really know what the reasons are for that. Some of it is because people who were self-employed have come up for retirement age and not left. In other cases, it's perhaps because there was nowhere for people to go. So there's always been a lot of churn in self-employment, and the churn has stopped. I think what we'll see as the economy recovers is that some of the self-employed will go back into employment, and some of that self-employment will start to unwind. I actually have a high-rolling bet with Ben over here about this business about whether the self-employed will overtake the number of workers in the public sector. And he says it will, and I say it won't. And we've got this. It's a high-rolling bet. It's index-linked. it's the 2 pints of beer.
Can I come in?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
There's another category of person, though, that should probably come into these calculations. And I don't know anything about the statistics, but the people who work for the self-employed, you know, shouldn't they be a sort of part of this? And so you might be able to argue that the fact that, you know, the growth in new businesses might be slowing down doesn't mean that the existing ones aren't doing well. If people aren't leaving that, then their business might be growing.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we have two staff. Where do they come in? You know, because they're a completely different kind of person to the person who wants to get a job in a big corporation, because they have a relative amount of freedom and autonomy too, and they enjoy being part of a small family, I hope. No, they hate it. What am I talking about? Dysfunctional family. But, you know, they've chosen to work for us rather than for a bigger company, and probably, you know, working harder and for less money in a lot of cases, especially at the beginning.
And Tom raises another point, which Ben has heard me go on about so many times, which is actually the way in which we're seeing the self-employed employ others, which is tends not to be through headcount, actually, through PAYE and National Insurance. And Dawn, I'm so glad you're nodding your head at this, is the way in which we're seeing lots of small businesses grow is through outsourcing and subcontracting to other freelancers. So again, back in the Home Business Survey, we estimated that freelancers themselves are employing about another 5 million because they outsource to freelancers. Talent. And the other great thing about that, despite the fact of I've just come from Tech City, where there's so many businesses located in one area, the brilliance of starting a business where you outsource work to the talent means that you're spreading wealth across the nation, because you're not dependent on that talent coming to sit with you in an office. So you can have a web designer in Cornwall, you can have an accountant in Nottingham, so you're spreading money across the country. But that's the way in which we're seeing these businesses grow.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Great. Shall we have some questions?
Thank you. My name is George Keyes. I'm a fellow. It's very easy to start as a self-employed, but it's very difficult to continue. And the reason sometimes happens is that if you have a retort of any large company towards you, not your customers, your provider, your supplier, your internet cable provider, a university, anything, you are not a consumer, technically speaking, in that relationship. And as a business, you are supposed to be big. And you don't have access to a legal department. So maybe there's a bit of entrepreneurial support that should be said. If you are creating employment for others, if you're a self-employer, what is the boundaries in which you access an ombudsman, in which you access equal access to free litigation, etc.? There are many cases where one tort can bring one entrepreneur down.
Mm. That's a good point. Thank you. Anybody else?
Thank you. Chris Mintz, I'm a fellow, but I also work for a London borough. What wider changes do we need to make in society? I'm thinking about careers advice in schools. I'm thinking about further education, colleges and universities. Young people are interested in business, but I'm not sure we're really supporting them and giving them the best start. So do we need to make some big structural changes in those areas to support this drive and perhaps to make it more effective?
Yeah, I found that our children have gone to all sorts of different London state schools. One of them is called Burlington Danes, which is a huge state school in White City. The headmistress there said that a lot of the kids were really interested in self-employment. A lot of them are the children of shopkeepers anyway. Mm. the things that and the education system as set up is not interested remotely in business. It's interested in getting people into jobs, and it's called the job market. And when you listen to, I mean, I remember very clearly, you know, comments from Gordon Brown on this. The purpose of education is to prepare children for the job market. Well, that to me is actually a very depressing statement for all sorts of reasons. So I think that should be countered, and we should be looking at igniting that entrepreneurial spirit in the kids. It's very easy to do, actually. You don't need particularly need a structural change. You just need to bung in some speakers every now and then, and yeah, to get them out to things like this. And any headmistress or headmaster could do that with a budget of £0, probably. Yeah.
So just to say, that is happening, and there's lots of change going on. So there's a man called Lord Young in government who recently wrote a report called Enterprise for All. He's just been given money in the budget to spin out a new careers company, as it's being called, which everything that this will do in this company is make sure that entrepreneurship is taught in schools. So there's going to be an enterprise passport. There's a digital platform called Plotter on which young people who want to work for startups will be able to go and work for them. The career service are involved in terms of making sure that they know that they have to do more. There's a competition called Tenor, which is about getting the kids starting businesses. There is something called School for Speakers that Robert Peston runs, which is all about getting business speakers into schools. So there is a huge kind of focus on saying, and especially kind of from Lord Young to say, and it's worth having a read of this Enterprise for All report, because it goes across literally from three-year-olds to say, let's encourage them to start thinking and being fit for the entrepreneurial world. And then just finally with FE colleges, there's a brilliant group called the Gazelle Group of Colleges, which is 27 FE colleges who've got a firm focus on saying that their kids will come in and learn vocational skills, but they will make sure that entrepreneurship is tagged onto it. So there's quite a lot happening, but the more schools that do it, the better.
Great, thank you.
Hi, I'm David Lightman and I'm a fellow. I've just set up a consultancy to help creative agencies grow, and given that we've just opened our doors this week and we're stepping onto virgin territory, is there any advice the panel would offer us?
Get yourself a good accountant. Seriously, it really does make a difference, because most people who start businesses aren't money people. They do it for different reasons. And we found the difference between having a really good accountant and, shall we say, a not-so-good accountant has made a lot of difference and just taken a lot of stress off.
Don't just look at what you do, but why you do it and how you do it.
Be extremely frugal. one of the things that people think they're going to start a business and be earning kind of the same. I mean, it's very true what Emma said, by the way, that your costs are going to massively go down if you don't have a job. And I say this to people a lot in our courses who are wondering whether to quit their job. The costs of a job are huge. If you just looked at it from a business perspective, the costs of working, you mentioned the clothes, yeah, the commuting, the little treats, the coffees, the lunches, because you can't afford to make sandwiches, the rewards to yourself because you've had a bad day, spending all your wages in the wine bar with people that you don't really like from the office while you complain about your boss. Yeah. It's complete and total utter waste of money, and you could halve your outgoings, but you're also probably not going to be earning very much at the outset, and so you need to think about how to cope with that. Sometimes we would advise people even to try and look at some other source of income at the beginning, and to combine that with trying to reduce your costs in every single area, so that you're not getting too stressed out by your outgoings.
And just as a final point on that, Tom's spoken about reducing your cost. Know your niche, which by the sounds of it you do, because I love the fact you're only focused on creative agencies and helping them grow. But the other thing that I think we keep on saying, this is the biggest sales opportunity for small business in 2015, is sell to government. So government has set itself a target of buying 25% of all its products and services from small business by May of this year, which is a phenomenal target. And so there's a website called Contracts Finder. And one of the big things, I don't know exactly what you offer, but one of the big things that government are looking for, yeah, is creative services, or just you going in and helping creative agencies grow. So, and check out Growth Accelerator, actually, because you can become a coach on there and get paid for that.
Very good practical advice. Gosh, we've got lots of hands. Maybe I'll take groups of three so that we can get a few more.
Thank you very much. Michael Parker, fellow and an accountant, self-employed. One of the things that took place, I think, in the 70s and 80s was to try and bring the market into accountancy. And we dropped quality for cheapness. and that's helped to destroy a lot of business. We talked about the growth, and the gentleman talked about the sustainability. Businesses will die without getting the right support, and just getting the quantity isn't right. But what we're missing is a change in philosophy of big businesses. They're interested in cost control, not growing business. And sometimes you need to spend to invest to get more income. And whilst that happens, that will constrain any creative influences. And we need that in government as well as the private sector. So we're missing out on that. And then people need to understand the risk and reward. So some accountants used to act as, pre-coaching days, the business coach. They tend not to do that because of this culture. And I think we need to do something a bit more than provide services, but try to get to the culture of society, because that is very, very different, which I thought the question was looking to answer.
Patricia made a very important succinct point that it is very important how we do this. And in within that context, how does the panel see the equalities agenda as well as the ethics agenda being fulfilled in the self-employment environment? By the way, my name is Dr. Carl Thompson. I'm chair of Equality in Lewisham, and I'm a fellow of the Royal Society as well.
Hi, I'm Anna Sexton. I run Open to Create, a creative agency. I'm also a fellow. Something that's coming up for me as a sole trader is I'm working for local authorities or large creative institutions. Some won't work with me because I'm a sole trader and are insisting I'm a limited company. I'm interested in doing that, but where's the ethics in that and equality? And also working for large cultural organisations that insist I'm on PAYE after I've invoiced, because now HMRC is cracking down on local authorities and institutions. So I want to know where I stand and how I can advise the people that I work with and be willing to sort of fit the mould, but also be an individual.
Brilliant, thank you. Okay, so we had Michael Porter, who was wondering whether we were missing the change in philosophy in big business and in culture generally. Does anyone want to speak to that point?
I feel as if I'm being way too gobby, but just the thing that I did think when you spoke is I think big business is playing a really good role in encouraging entrepreneurship. Again, this goes back to my rosiness and positivity, but if you look sort of in the past 2 years, Telefonica have opened an accelerator called Wira. John Lewis have opened something called J-Lab, where they're looking for new innovations. M&S have got digital labs where they're calling out on startups. Unilever have opened Unilever Foundry. There's one called The Bakery, which Procter & Gamble have got an investment in. So when I talk to big business now, and we talk to them a lot, is every big company wants the innovation and the entrepreneurial spirit that comes from small startups. They all want it because they're slow. The breakfast I just came from this morning, there was a guy from KPMG who, bless him, he's an accountant, naturally, and they've opened an office in Shoreditch, and he said, it's great, I can grow a beard and wear cardigans. I'm like, okay, that's lovely job satisfaction for you. But what I love is KPMG, in their right, honest minds, have moved into Shoreditch with 12 people to say they want to be the heart of techland to help these businesses get going, get funded, get accelerated. So actually, I think big business, and I'd love to see this as the leveller, because I think there has been a bit of a them and us attitude between small and large, especially, you know, Amazon. You're a merchant who sells on Amazon, they take 70% of your profits, well, however much of your profits they take. So I think what startups could be is levelling that out in terms of big business saying, look, we need your entrepreneurial spirit, we need your innovation. What the small businesses need from the big is access to market, and we are seeing much more of those kind of profitable partnerships coming together.
Great, thank you. And then does anyone want to talk about the equalities agenda, and then also a bit of advice on being a sole trader versus being a limited partnership?
I'm quite interested in the equality thing, and indeed, like I see, it was quite interesting recently, indeed, having a big meeting at Enterprise Nation with the VetMoss, and this was about online businesses, and there were 9 very feisty women in their 30s, and all had kids. And I think there is a very changing kind of role, and this is indeed like something that I deal with quite a lot with, that a lot of people still think, like, to be an entrepreneur, you need to be ruthless, you need to have a grey suit, and you need to have grey hair. Mm-hmm. I don't have any of that except for the grey hair. But like, it's that kind of attitude, and I think that is something that I really want to show my daughters. And they are very keen, and we can do good stuff with it as well as making a lot of money and making it a good society. So,
Great, thank you. And then a bit of practical advice, and then I think we have to end because...
Well, on that one, I've done both. I've had a partnership, I've been a sole trader, and now have a limited company as well. So I've done all of them. But if ever we wanted advice on those issues, definitely join the FSB, the Federation of Small Businesses. I don't know if you're a member of it already.
And as you say, it could be that the issue, and it is easy to move from sole trader to limited company. I know what you're saying is, do you have to do that? And I guess, as you say, what the council is worried about is that if anything goes wrong and you're a sole trader, you're personally liable financially. But if you're a limited company, they could sue the company, but that doesn't impact, well, it impacts you, but it's not you financially. So maybe, and I don't know, they're kind of concerned on your behalf that they kind of wouldn't want... Really? Local authorities aren't that horrid. That is so bad. You cynics, you. It could be that reason. So, but maybe you and I can have a chat, because, as you say, with the government at a central level saying all local authorities, central government, should spend more with small businesses, I'm surprised that they're not looking for reasons to spend with you.
If you look at the stats, last year there was an increase in the number of one-person companies. So I don't know if that's reflecting that, but the number of self-employed people doing it through companies has actually, there's been a slight uptick in it over the last year, which maybe that's the reason behind it.
Great. Thank you very much, everyone, and thank you very much to the panel for some really interesting comments. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.